Welcome to Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded list, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles which we think deserve more acclaim and to which attention must be paid. I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
I'm Matt. I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums from 1985 until 2015, starting with number one and working down.
Once we have finished these lists off, we'll do some fun activities with the new replacement list we've collaborated on. But before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title we replaced is The Bridge on the River Kwai, directed by David Lean.
What just happened?
Oh. It's all right. If you're listening to this at home, I cut something out, which was the sound of me scrolling, but it's okay. So we're going to talk Bridge on the River Kwai, which is back to one of my, it is my favorite pet peeve about the American Film Institute list.
Which is saying something, readers.
This is my favorite, one, just that they insist on missing out on the American portion of it. Bridge on the River Kwai is a British film. It just is. Like, just because it got distributed by Columbia does not mean that it is not a British film. It's almost hard to come up with a more British film in many ways. It is commenting on Britishness throughout with its British director, its British actors, and it's just there's so much. Anyway, go ahead.
So, then why do you call Cloud Atlas a German film?
Cloud Atlas is a German film because Tom Teichfer is German, and he's got enough of his footprints on this.
Chowskis aren't.
I know, but There's two of them. It's not about a fist fight, like who's going to win.
No, I meant ratios, two out of three.
It's... Oh boy!
It's a matter of weight ratio,
like a Festivus pole.
Yeah, there you go. No, that, yeah. I mean, partially that was cheeky, but it was also serious. Like, why is that German and this is?
So funding matters, like funding and production matters, but it for me that's more of a distinguishing factor when the rest of the film is pretty like all over the place, which. I mean, Cloud Atlas is kind of the perfect example of a movie having everything in it. Like, there's not a...
Set nowhere in Germany.
Nope, set nowhere in Germany. Not really set in America in any real way. Like,
There's a whole section set in America.
Right, there's the San Francisco one. Like, there's... I don't know. To me, it's a very international film, and... I'll take the combination of the director who I like not to have a whole fight about Cloud Atlas at the start of the Bridge on the River Kwai thing, but to me, that's more
going to make it happen somewhere
that to me, that's more Tom Teichfer than the Wachowskis anyway. Like, I think there's more of him in that one. I know.
If we sound like parents fighting at the dinner table, dear listeners, I've been waiting for this moment for many episodes, but we will move forward with the Britishness.
Yeah, so it's actually, I mean, it is interesting because I thought about breaking my rule about not doing, like, international movies for this one, because, like, clearly they didn't care. And I was thinking, like, do I want to put movies that we call American even though they're not, and then Cloud Atlas would have been an interesting choice. But one of the reasons we don't do Cloud Atlas on here is because I don't know why we would do an episode where the ending is foreordained quite that.
No. We thought the ending of Whenever You Invoked Ferris Bueller was preordained, and see, I'm good.
Yeah, but that's a question of love versus hate.
Yeah. And? I think strong hate is as compelling as strong love.
Oh, dear. And we just did this thing about sincerity and everything. That's not twee at all. Nothing about this is twee.
Neither is Bridge to the River Kwai.
That's a great point. So a bridge, the Bridge on the River Kwai is this. I think it's kind of a misunderstood movie in a lot of ways, not because of the ideas in the movie, which I think everybody understands at this point. Like, it's not a World War II heroism movie. And you think about the other like prison movies from World War II, whether that's Stalag 17 or that's The Great Escape. Those movies are more fun.
Slaughterhouse 5,
for example. Like, Stalag 17 has like the sad ending, and I mean, Great Escape has the sad ending too, and this one has, I don't want to call it a more cheerful ending, because that's not the right word, but it has an ending which is a little bit more rousing than those do. But it's a lot less fun on the way to that conclusion. I think it's a film where everybody knows about the basic rivalry between Nicholson and Saito, played by Alec Guinness and by Sessu Hayakawa, about how the two of them have this staring match in which Nicholson has this very strong opinion that the Geneva Convention must be followed, and he refuses to bend to conditions like the officers working on the bridge. And then when it comes time that the Japanese need the bridge built by a certain point, and Saito has no choice but to cave to this demand, then Nicholson becomes like the owner of the bridge, and everybody starts asking questions like, hey man, why are you doing such a good job building this bridge for our enemies right now? Isn't that weird? And of course that has not occurred to him, because he's seeking out his own legacy. That part I think everybody gets. And I think it's very obviously mirrored in the story with Jack Warden and William Holden playing these sort of rivals, the American former POW who was pretending to be a commander because he was hoping for better treatment, and the former Cambridge Don who loves blowing stuff up and has a fetish about completing missions no matter how many holes are in his feet. And like, that's going on, and there's dialogue about that as well. And that's all, again, this is the stuff that dads the world over have glommed onto. This is one of the foremost films in the dad movie canon, which is really saying something, because I know we have definitely covered a number of these pictures.
I know we talked about Massachusetts Guy for the decile, but dad movie canon.
Oh, I've almost made that the theme for a week before, but when I blew Hunt for Red October, I sort of started feeling like maybe the best example of it had been disappeared.
I don't know. There's plenty of John Wayne out there.
There's a lot left to do, but I don't know. Just like, how many submarine movies can I choose? I think I'd have to like go back and find a way to sneak Ice Station Zebra in here or something. Like, that's the way that would have to go. Where I think this movie is kind of misunderstood a little bit is within the corpus of David Lean's work. And by rights, they shouldn't have let me talk about David Lean on this podcast, because he did not make American movies. However, they gave me that opening. What?
I said, who's they?
The American Film Institute.
I know, they don't even know we exist, though.
That doesn't matter. They let it happen.
I'm saying, you could have had fun and just, like, totally replaced this movie with something else.
Oh. Well, that wouldn't have been honest.
No, I know. The first part was sincerity. This part is not.
It is, I mean, it is funny that we're talking about this, because if we looked at the 98 list, Dr. Zhivago was pretty high on that. Not an American movie. Just okay, they
I'm not disagreeing with you that this isn't an American movie. Like, it opened up my Cloud Atlas feelings, but Dr. Zhivago, come on, man.
What?
I'm yelling at the AFI, not you.
Like, just, there's nothing about that movie. Like, Rod Steiger's in it, and that's it. Like, they're one Rod Steiger away from literally everyone else not being American. It just, I don't understand how they pulled that off. And of course, we have to get to Lawrence of Arabia later. Not an American movie, but like, but I think there are other things I'm going to want to hit for Lawrence. So for this one, I think it's useful to talk about David Lean's career. And this is a movie which I had seen enough times that I like didn't feel like I really needed to go back and watch it. This is a movie which, as is the truth for many dad movies, I have been seeing in bits and pieces since I was about seven. Like, it's just one of those. But I am at a point in my life now where I've seen all of the David Lean narrative features. About a year ago, I made a point to go clean up the rest that I hadn't run across already. And at this point, I've got all 16. I'll ask you, what do you know about David Lean's movies? Like, what, when you hear the name, what do you take away from that?
I do think British.
It'd be hard not to at this point, for sure.
What do I think? He's one of your favorites, isn't he?
Yeah.
I'm not deferring, I'm just collecting my thoughts.
No, I have a real soft spot for him. He, Mike Lee, and Terrence Davies are my completely unlike each other trio of British directors.
How do I want to put this? I don't know, sort of like epics of identity formation or finding. And generally there's some like core relationship in there, like kind of finding yourself through others or like understanding yourself through it, like something like that. But there's kind of I kind of think of like a loneliness in it.
Yeah.
Or like a sterileness perhaps.
Yeah. There's a lot of loneliness, and I think the word epic has to come into it, right? Like,
I did think about that. I thought I said it, but
no, you did.
Oh,
you
okay.
did. That's why. That's I'm seizing on that. So, like, if you think about Lawrence of Arabia, the fundamental loneliness of this person with character foils all around him, but who can never really like fit into this world he falls in love with. Passage to India, epic film about people who are, again, truly isolated, some of whom do it to themselves and others have it done to them. Dr. Zhivago.
Isolation, that's a good word.
Yeah, Dr. Yeah. Zhivago has that as well. Ryan's Daughter, which is not as highly regarded today, though I think it's one of his best movies, has something very similar. This like giant epic scope of Ireland around the time of the Civil War. So like, he's probably best remembered for these movies, and of course for Bridge on the River Kwai, which is from 1957 and predates all of the ones I just mentioned.
I know Brief Encounter is the one, though.
Oh my God, Brief Encounter is the one. I mean, like, but the thing about him is that he gets his start as an editor, and then he makes movies with Noel Coward. He makes three of them with him. Or no, four. There are four that have like some level of Coward influence on them, including Brief Encounter, which is quite simply one of the 10 greatest movies ever made. And there's also like goofy stuff like Blythe Spirit, which is so strange. It's almost hard to describe how weird Blythe Spirit is. He does multiple World War II movies before this, like In Which We Serve. This Happy Breed is a Homefront movie. Breaking the Sound Barrier, which I first learned about through The Right Stuff. It has... Do you want to talk about this? This will take like 30 seconds, but yes. It's hilarious. Like, the guys who were like in the flight, like the flight programs were like watching this movie about this guy breaking the sound barrier, and basically the way he does it is instead of like moving the stick one way, he moves the stick another way, and like every like the guys who were actually in these programs just absolutely lost their minds. They're like, what is this? Like, what are we watching here? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say top five, go.
Oh, well, I actually have this listed. It's Brief Encounter, Lawrence of Arabia, and then The Passionate Friends, which is just Brief Encounter with another person. It's a very similar vibe. I have Ryan's Daughter fourth. I think that one is, maybe, like, I'm saying this very carefully, but it's very possible that's his most beautiful movie. And then Hobson's Choice, which is another, like, a goofy comedy. The silly comedy about Charles Laughton as this slightly pompous, slightly drunk cobbler who gets completely, completely worked over by his daughter and his top assistant who he kept in the basement for so long. Like, it's this very, like, funny movie. But Hobson's Choice kind of brings us into this other side of Lean, which is that he kind of made his name not with Noel Coward, but by making Dickens adaptations. So yeah, I mean, his Great Expectations is not like the book, but is a
like, well, the original Great Expectations. Is, yeah, not like, I digress.
Yeah, it is very much not like it, but it is an incredible, incredibly atmospheric film. Like, it's definitely got more. It's got more Wuthering Heights in it than anything else, but it's really spectacular in that way. And then his Oliver Twist, which I put off for a really long time, you know, except for the anti-Semitism that got it banned in multiple countries. Well, except for that, a really terrific movie. Like, that one does such a good job with it. And, like, you're just looking at Alec Guinness under, like, it's incredible how many Alec Guinness performances are in these movies for a few reasons. One of them, I mean, they're a classic pair. Lean and Guinness are a classic pair in the same way that, like, I don't know, Ford and Wayne are a classic pair, or the way that Scorsese and De Niro are a classic pair. Like, it's one of those. They hated each other. Like, the two of them just did not get along at all. They were, like, just always at loggerheads with one another. The other thing that's really funny about this is that if you look at the number of Alec Guinness roles, you have him playing Fagin in Oliver Twist. You have him playing an Arab in Lawrence of Arabia. You have him playing an Indian in A Passage to India. And you're just like, my brother, is there not a way that you could just maybe play a white guy more often? Just play someone straight up without racial, religious, or ethnic prejudice. Like, could you, like, and the thing about Passage to India is that movie is from 1984. Like, Lawrence of Arabia has some stuff in it, and you're like, this is weird. And it's 1962, and you're like, this is how it used to work. But in 1984, just stunning. Absolutely stunning.
Is Obi-Wan the closest he got
to
just playing a white guy?
Well, I mean, he does it here too.
Oh,
and like the fun thing about Guinness too is, like, he gets his start as being this really, really good, weird comic actor. So I think one of my all-time favorite Guinness performances is in this satire of capitalism called The Man in the White Suit. Are you familiar with this one?
No, but you had me at the pole line.
Okay, so there's this scientist who discovers this this material which will never tear, rip, stain, anything like that, and it, like, comes out in this incredibly bright white, essentially, so it's like permanent clothing. Like, you will never need to buy clothes again. And of course the capitalists freak out because they're like, oh my god, what are we gonna sell? But then also all of the unionists and the people in the mills freak out because they're like, oh my god, what are we gonna sell? So both sides of the world, capital and labor, are like out to kill him at the end of the movie. Like it's a very pointed, very funny, and like really dark little satire. Alec Guinness is in the Lavender Hill Mob, which is this really funny movie about a bank robbery. He is the star of The Lady Killers, which the Coens remade. So instead of being a fake Southern gentleman like Tom Hanks, he's playing this weird raspy voice person who looked like he went through electroshock therapy just before he got onto camera. He's in Kind Hearts and Coronets, where he plays, I think it's 8 different roles, all members of the same family. It's a very weird career. And to think that he...
Doesn't he play Jacob Marley?
I think he must have somewhere. I don't even know. But like just the fact that he gets his Oscar for playing this very serious, not funny at all, in many ways kind of loathsome character at the center of Bridge on the River Kwai, maybe like the most loathsome person in the movie, which is really saying something. It's so strange. It's so weird that this sort of daffy seeming comedian turns it around and plays this icon of very last breath of British Empire Britishness and gets rewarded for it there. And of course it's a tremendous part and it's a tremendous performance. Like that's not to like defame that at all. It's very weird that this is like one of the two most iconic Guinness roles, given that so many of his other parts are just not like this at all.
So it's like when Adam Sandler should have won for Uncut Gems.
It is in fact almost exactly like Adam Sandler and the way he should have won for Uncut Gems. Yeah, that's actually like genuinely, this is a very good analog.
Sandman got robbed. Important question. Do you have either of the Lady Killers anywhere?
Well, one of them's British. And then...
That doesn't stop the AFI.
And then the other answer... I've thought about trying to poke
this
that
is a
one
long
in
way
somewhere.
Of saying no.
But no, I can't quite do it. To take this back to Lean for a second... Bridge on the River Kwai usually gets lumped in as like maybe his first really epic movie, his first movie with that kind of scope. And after rewatching it, I was just really struck by how much I didn't agree with that point of view. He definitely does some of those big shots that he's famous for. It's not that it doesn't include that, but it just in tone and in cinematography, it just reminds me so much more of the Dickens movies. There are some real big shots in Great Expectations. It starts with this thunderstorm, this really eerie mood setting tracking shot, and then Oliver Twist has at the very end on the rooftop like a really enormous seeming crowd scene, and those are much more like what happens in Bridge than anything that's happening in Lawrence. Like it's just a completely different kind of approach. And this is kind of his last version of a relatively intimate story. Like I think it's probably fair to say that his 40s movies are extremely intimate. The 50s movies are somewhat intimate, and then the stuff from the 60s on is like epic. I don't disagree with that particular reading. I mean, it's cool to be able to talk about David Lean, who I have this terrible fear that I refer to as David Lynch at some point in here. I wouldn't be surprised if I had. Bridge on the River Kwai is not a movie that needs a lot of explanation, especially because I think most people have seen it. Most people have dads who have forced them to watch some piece of it at one time or another. And it definitely... The name tells you a lot about what happens in the movie, for sure.
I don't think you've said Lynch at all, because I probably would have made a joke about that, but...
That's reassuring.
Yeah. I know. Are we sure about that last part, though?
I mean, we can do a quickie, like, plot synopsis slash...
Well, less that, but more like, I know this is a peak dad movie, but I don't... Are we sure that it is one that's getting communicated to or thrust upon the youth of today? Like, I don't know about that one.
Oh, I doubt very much that it's being thrust on the youth of today, but, like, I think... For the generation of basic cable Sunday TV watchers, like, this is definitely part of that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that young people are all hey sailor about Bridge on the River Kwai, but, like, it's definitely got an understanding of, like, oh, that's the one with the POW camp in Thailand, like, with the bridge. Like, I think most people know that.
That makes sense. I mean, we said it in the last part, but, like, I'm curious what happens with this one going forward, though. Movie time is much longer than music time, so it's going to be, like, 50 years before anything would happen. But.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because this movie has dropped a fair bit. I'd have to go look up the list again, but here we are, and I think it's what, 35 or something. Yeah. And in the original list, I'm almost positive that it was top 20. Yeah, it was 13th. It was 13th when you go back there. And just to compare, Dr. Zhivago's around here somewhere. Dr. Zhivago was 39th. there's nothing like seeing the producer on something in the American film thing, and, like, you're at least for Bridge on the River Kwai, you're like Horizon American Pictures and, like, Sam Spiegel and released now by Columbia, and you go down to Dr. Zhivago and it's Carlo Ponti who was Italian. Like, just truly puzzling how anyone came to this conclusion. But yes, I think you're right that this is a movie which went from being recognized as, like, one of your slam dunk, no doubt about it, all timers, what, like, 25 years ago, and now it's being recognized as a very great movie, not necessarily one of the ones that we feel a great need to highlight. I think that's definitely happening.
Yeah, I'm just curious, like, how the dad canon is going to shift without dads who grew up on basic cable broadcasting.
Oh, I think it'll just become the granddad canon, because right now the dad canon is the same as everybody else's. It no longer has that pungent flavor about it.
Sorry. Pungent flavor in a World War II movie. It's just...
No, it's definitely a pungent-looking movie. I mean, you can absolutely smell all those British guys, including the one who looks exactly like Gordon Ramsay. I feel like I know exactly what he smells like.
What does he smell like, Tim?
Oh, he smells like sweat and dirt. And, like, no, he just met someone with beriberi, and that stink is still on him. And
okay.
If he looks like Gordon Ramsay this much, which really it's an absolutely uncanny resemblance, probably also smells like a very fancy beef Wellington.
With some beriberi.
Yeah, with beriberi sauce. Absolutely.
That makes sense.
All right, so the theme for the Bridge on the River Kwai.
I'm so excited.
Actually, I was going to keep you in suspense slightly longer. We'll talk about it. So Matt will get to choose which movie best suits that theme based on the arguments presented. And of course, all chosen movies head to their subtitles replacement list. Remember, too, that the goal is not to choose the work that's best or most important, but to choose the one that best suits the theme. So how long has it been since you've seen this one?
Oof. Long enough that I don't remember.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean, that's part of the dad canonness of it all.
But I, like, I was about to say that, like, that works for me. It was more a question of, like, I don't know how much that happens anymore, but that was my experience with it.
So you do remember the, like, there's the two plots. So basically there's the plot at the POW camp. William Holden escapes the POW camp by some miracle, and then he gets sent back by the British on their strike team to the forest moon of Endor to blow up the bridge. So, like, we that okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you remember the people on that. It's Jack Hawkins playing Warden, William Holden playing Shears. And then the other guy is Jeffrey Horn, who is not as well known, who this might have been his first movie. He was in a few others after that, some of which people have even heard of, but he never became like a big star. He plays the Montreal-born Joyce.
And who are the Ewoks?
Oh, boy. I mean, do you want the real answer to that? Because it's racist.
No, not anymore.
Okay. Like, there there is, yeah, an answer. It's also it's also got, if we really take that to a new level, it also feels like bestiality, so let's just really not talk about it. But that's like the three main dudes on this mission. And there's some question, even though Joyce is like the star of combat school, like best grades in almost everything, super proficient with his knife and at swimming and all of that stuff. When they interview him at first, the commanders, they ask, do you think you can kill someone? And he's like, I don't know, which is, you know, like a reasonable response in some respect. Like, I have no idea if I can just kill a dude who's not trying to kill me. And at the same time, that's absolutely the wrong answer for when you're on this kind of mission, because that's like kind of the point of war, is that you're supposed to kill people. And he finds out that no, he can't do it at one point, that he is in fact not capable of killing a guy in cold blood. He and Warden are trying to track down this one Japanese soldier at one point who has seen them. And of course, if he gets back to his camp, the mission's blown. And Joyce finds him first. The Japanese soldier just sort of rises up out of the forest and he stares at him. Neither one of them does anything. And then Warden comes in, stabs the guy to death, but also takes a serious wound in his foot in so doing. So that is like one of the major points of the film. And then, of course, at the end of the film, maybe things could have been avoided or changed a teensy weensy bit if Joyce had tried to kill Nicholson when Nicholson comes over and starts exploring who is going to blow up his precious, precious bridge. So this is, I mean, it's an important part of this. I think everybody in the film understands the necessity of having to like kill in cold blood, even if it's something which is distasteful to most of them. But it to me is one of the central turning points in the film, the sort of recognition of there are people who will not kill, or there are people who are afraid to take that responsibility on, which not what the movie's about, but worthwhile, definitely worthwhile. This reminded me of something I read on the internet in the past couple months, and we'll see if you recognize it. Chief, Dracula is in our sights. Take the shot. Sniper, I can't, sir. I'm woke. Me, watching through binoculars. He's woke. He won't do it. The theme for this week is drill tweets as movies. So in the last episode, we talked about sincerity.
Hang on. I'm upset that you're doing this for only
three movies.
Oh, I know. And I even, it's funny. I was really thinking hard. I was thinking so hard about doing Cat People for this, because Cat People would allow me to do, if the zoo bans me for hollering at the animals, I will face God and walk backwards into hell, which I know is your favorite. And I'm like, I can't put that one in here.
It's so good.
So I've spent,
that is my favorite one.
I've spent most of my weekend doing different movies that might fit into drill tweets. Because as I was watching Bridge on the River Kwai, I'm like, there are so many different ways to go with this. It is genuinely a very, very dense text, and I could find so many different things. And then I'm watching this movie. I'm watching this Japanese soldier rise up out of the underbrush, and all I can hear is, he's woke. He won't do it.
Did that make the movie better or worse?
Honestly, a little bit better.
Oh, okay.
Not like a lot better, but like, it was a little bit better in that moment. So the theme this week is, I mean, I've spent all weekend doing this, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. But basically, it's about drill tweets as films. You know, my favorite one is the Betsy Ross Museum one. So for those of us who are not aware, this one, another day volunteering at the Betsy Ross Museum. Everyone keeps asking me if they can fuck the flag. Buddy, they won't even let me fuck it. Fuck the flag. And I'm like, if I thought National Treasure was just a little bit better, I would have done that.
Oh.
I know. Oh. I know. So we have two options. The films that we're going to approach are The Kane of Comedy and The Insider. The Kane of Comedy, 1983, directed by Martin Scorsese, and The Insider from 1999, directed by Michael Mann. Any questions or concerns about this theme, or are we ready to go?
I feel ready to go. I have a feeling our listeners may not be as well versed in drill as us, so I think it is worth, like,
here, do you want to do that real quick? I'll make sure I'm prepared and you can try to explain drill to people.
Oh god. Drill is a phenomenal Twitter account that is truly the Nostradamus of our time. And some idiot Killjoy went through the work of trying to figure out who Drill was, and I think did, and it's so not the point. It's this anonymous Twitter account that does the most absurdist and non sequitur things, and leads to just incredible pull quotes and one-liners. And it is, I don't know, the most active period was probably the early 2010s. And so many of them have become, like, big historical moment happens. Oh, there's a drill tweet for that. And also, just the style of humor and writing is so evocative of what the internet has become. Like, I talked about Belle and Sebastian as sneakily the most influential. Drill is, like, king of Twitter, certainly. King of the internet, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm trying to, like, there are so many things that I don't think people understand or, like, drill origin, but, like, the candles tweet, like, someone who's good at the economy, help me budget this, my family is dying, like, that's one of them. The insult corn cob, I'm pretty sure, comes from the drill tweet.
I'm not owned. I insist as I shrink into a corn cob.
That one is one of them that I think everybody has. I don't know. Like, there are just so many of these that are foundational to understanding what people are saying online. And that's the basic drill synopsis.
The whole thing smacks of gender, I say, as I overturn the barbecue.
Turn the 4th of July into the 4th of shit. I thought about doing Independence Day for that one. I thought that was also pretty on the nose, but
If your grave doesn't say rest in peace, you were drafted into the Skeleton War.
The Evil Dead. I thought very hard about doing Evil Dead for that. See, I spent my whole weekend trying to just going through drill tweets, which was wonderful, and then thinking, like, what does this remind me of?
There's actually zero difference between good and bad, you imbecile, you fucking moron.
I also, the last one I'll tease here is the walks into a bathroom, 9/11 is happening. I'm like, do I want to do United 93 for this, or is that too much?
Actually,
if From Here to Eternity hadn't been on the 98 list, I almost certainly would have done that, because that, of course, ends with Pearl Harbor. Just like, hey, get out of the bathroom, Pearl Harbor is happening.
One more. Oh, there's so many good ones. Another, awfully, awfully bold of the Goodyear blimp to be flying in a year this bad.
Somehow we have not even mentioned the two that I've got for this, so... Which is just a show of how deep this roster of great tweets is. So, The King of Comedy. Have you seen The King of Comedy?
I've never have, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting. This movie is the follow-up to Raging Bull, which even in 1980 was recognized as this absolutely phenomenal film. And, of course, it brings back Scorsese and De Niro together. I mean, it's also kind of hard to overstate how much Raging Bull was thought of, not just as a phenomenon, but like, okay, Marty's got it again. Like, there was definitely this period between the whole, you know, like, cocaine thing and New York, New York, which people hated, but I think is better than The King of Comedy, so shoot me, I guess.
The human mind, the second most powerful thing.
That was going to be T2. I thought about T2 for that. Like, my whole weekend. The whole weekend was spent on this. But, like, King of Comedy. Actually, go ahead.
Sorry. There is one more that I think has infiltrated larger culture that is a drill tweet. Oh. And it's the, you, under any circumstances, do not have to hand it to him.
I was trying to think of one for that, about the terror group ISIL.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of one for that, and I just couldn't quite get there with it. But yeah, that one was very tempting to me as well. We still have not hit either one of the two.
There's so many.
So I've not hit either one of the two that we're actually using. So this film was recognized, I think, in the time people were disappointed by it. And now it's turned into kind of like a Letterboxd / film Twitter cool kid film, like the kind of movie where people like show their bona fides for saying, like, oh, actually, this is like a top five Scorsese movie. Like, it's turned into that. It's definitely been reevaluated in a lot of ways. And of course, nothing. Has quite ruined this movie for a generation of people, like Joker just absolutely ripping, tearing all of it. Do you want to share the drill tweet about the Joker? Because I thought about using that one for this and still didn't even use it.
I don't remember the Joker one offhand, but I was going to ask, I don't know if I should do it now. I have a guess for the King of Comedy one.
Okay, I'm gonna read the one I didn't use, which
okay,
is...
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
The judge orders me to take off my anonymous V-mask, and I'm wearing the Joker makeup underneath it. Everyone in the courtroom groans at my shit. Which is basically the plot of Joker. Thought real hard about that for King of Comedy. Do you have a thought? Do you have a guess?
I did, but I'm not sure about it the more I think of it. Is Wario a libertarian one?
Oh my god, I love Wario as a libertarian. No, it's not Wario as a libertarian. Let's go through the plot real quick. So the plot of this movie is about this would-be comedian played by Robert De Niro. His name is Rupert Pupkin, which is one of the best jokes in the movie. And there's, man, something I really love about it is the way that the film lapses so easily between what he's imagining and what actually happens. And it's not like there's a lot of confusion. I think the last scene of the film is very much, it's very sly about what actually happens. It's the same ending as Taxi Driver, weirdly enough. But there is this common like back and forth where you get the sense that he's not even seeing the world in like ways in which it actually exists. This guy who's like not funny, like his stand-up set is not good. And we see the stand-up set at the end when he has successfully managed to get into late night television. The way that he did that, he first tried to go in a pretty straightforward way. He frequently waits outside the building where Jerry Langford, played by Jerry Lewis, in just a very, very good, very, very dour part. He is constantly waiting out there. He manages to get in his car one night, tries to convince him that he should listen to his tape, sends the tape over to the network. There's a shocking amount of this movie that's set in the same receptionist office where he just waits around waiting for people to listen to his tape and waits for Jerry to like give him an invitation to come on the show. At one point he manages to get his way to Jerry's house, which is horrifying for everyone involved except for Rupert. Eventually, what it comes down to is that he and his friend, who is not his frenemy, is a better way to put it, his frenemy Masha, who is kind of in love with Jerry, not kind of, like, profoundly and frighteningly in love with Jerry, he gets her help to kidnap him and then uses that as leverage to get onto the Jerry Langford show and do his set. In front of his audience of 80 plus million people, because that's how primetime used to work. So that's the basic through line of the film, in which we see how Rupert is this striver addicted to the grind, but also, as is so true for so many people who are addicted to the grind, they're also addicted to their own delusion, like the fact that if you grind enough, it will turn into something, as opposed to if you grind enough, all you will do is annoy the people you're trying to get in with. So that's the basic thrust of this film.
I have two more guesses, which seems unfair.
No, go ahead, because I was going to reveal at this point anyway, okay. So two more is good.
Everyone tells me not to mansplain, but is anyone thinking about man's pain? No.
It's not one of them.
Okay, the other one is, it is with heavy heart I announced that the celebs are at it again.
Nope, it is not that one either.
Okay, put me out of my misery.
Go ahead, keep screaming shut the fuck up at me. Oh. It only makes my opinions worse.
Fuck, I forgot about that one.
Yep, that is the one for this movie, because that is Rupert Pupkin. Just in a constant world where people try to tell him no, or to calm down, or to just like act like a normal person. And the more they do it,
is screaming, log off, show yourself.
I will never log off. It's the same idea. I thought about doing that for this one too. But like just this complete belief in his own delusional mindset, believing that he is going to be the next comedy sensation, and he has these scripts that he writes out for other people to say, which pump him up. He has these conversations with people in his life. For one example is Rita, who is kind of his girlfriend, mostly not, someone who like is a bartender basically, and who he sort of wishes he were in a relationship with, and she sort of like tags along occasionally. He goes through his autograph book with her, and then at the very end of it he's like, guess who this is? the name starts with R, and she's like, is it Robert Redford? And he's like, no, it's me. It's Rupert Pupkin. And then he tears it out and gives it to her, like, which is like par for the course for what he's like during this movie. Just a person who is completely incapable of getting the hint. I think the question about this movie is whether or not it's actually that funny. I don't think it's particularly funny. I know other people think it's like a real scream, and I understand where that comes from. It's definitely beyond cringy, because I think cringe is like, you know, you think about your favorite cringe people, whether that's like Steve Carell or Kristen Wiig or whoever, and they're kind of in on the joke with you. Like, you feel like the comedian is in on the joke with you. Robert De Niro is obviously a better actor than those two, and he doesn't let you in on the joke at any point. What's uncomfortable about the Rupert Pupkin performance is that he really feels like he might be a serial killer by day and a wannabe stand-up comic by night, which again is why Todd Phillips ripped this movie so hard for Joker. But the fact that he just is so much invested in his own vision of the future, the fact that he has cutouts while he's living in his mom's basement, he's got cutouts of Liza Minnelli and Jerry Langford and like the crowd in the audience, and like practices being with them and laughing at jokes with them. But never do we see him actually practice his own routine. He's like dreaming of being famous and being fated so hard that he has completely lost the plot on what it might take for him to actually turn into a stand-up guy. Like, for example, doing any kind of stand-up comedy in front of other people. like doing it in like nightclubs or like open mics or things like that. Like, none of that appears to occur to him. It really just is, he wants to be everything or he's gonna be nothing, which is reflected in the last line of his stand-up set, which is that it's better to be king for a night than to be a schmuck for a lifetime. Thoughts about this one, including the theme of drill tweets that takes us to go ahead, keep shouting shut the fuck up at me. It only makes my opinions worse. Because, I mean, that really is like a great one-sentence synopsis of this movie.
Mm-hmm. No, I did start wandering off into like an assessment of cringe widely, which is something I have feelings about, I guess. Not feelings. I like well done cringe comedy, and it's very, very hard to do. But what you say about how De Niro's playing it here is really interesting. And it's more or less my understanding of the movie. Like, I haven't seen it, but it is one that I'm very familiar with before the Joker even. And that it's like, if you saw this dude in real life performing, that would be cringe because you're uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But cringe itself is a performative thing. Like, it's a shared uncomfortableness that then becomes funny. But this is just like deeply upsetting, like viscerally upsetting. So like, it's anti-comedy in a way on Scorsese's part. Mm-hmm. Like, the way De Niro is playing it is just like, this is a horrible person. But I suppose my wrap up here is that this is the complete opposite of New Sincerity.
Yeah, I should say so. I mean, what's one of the things that's so fascinating about the last part of this movie too is like, there is a certain amount of brilliance in the idea of, if you kidnap the stand-up comic, mm-hmm. and you kidnap the guy who's on late night, who's super famous, who everybody's watching every night, if you kidnap that guy and say, the thing where like you're saying what you want, my terms for his release are, you let me go on the show and do a stand-up set, and then you'll get him back. To some extent, this is a great plan, because it's not that crazy an ask, right? Like, you get the guy back unharmed, and all you have to do is film it. Whether or not it even gets aired is, like, a different question, right? Because, like, maybe you can voice that off. And then on the other hand, it's an obviously stupid plan, because if you're the guy who gets called in, then obviously it's you who kidnapped him. And one of the things that's so great about this movie is that Rupert just shows up and, like, the first guy he talks to, this actually is, like, maybe the best joke in the entire thing. He goes up to this camera guy, and the code name that he's given himself is The King, so people will know that it's him when he shows up. And he goes up to this camera guy and says, "I'm the King." And the camera guy has no idea who this is. Why should he? He's the camera guy. And at one point he's like, "Yeah, man, we have your throne ready for you in your dressing room." And, like, is just, like, absolutely giving it to him, until eventually Rupert finds someone he's met before and introduces himself as the Kane, and it works. But just, like, it's a great plan as long as you know you're going to jail, which is kind of what happens. Rupert spends a lot of the last half hour, 45 minutes of this movie surrounded by FBI agents who are just like talking to him, being like, "You realize you should consider yourself under arrest, right?" And he's like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's a very good explanation of, like, it only makes my opinions worse. You know, the more you bring it up to me, the more I will double down on this. The more you try to convince me that what I'm doing is ludicrous and terrible, you will not stop me. You will not be able to prevent me from doing this terrible, bad thing.
I will never log off.
All right. The other film that I've got for us is The Insider, which is not my favorite Michael Mann movie.
What is your favorite Michael Mann movie?
It's Manhunter.
Okay.
You know what my second favorite Michael Mann movie is?
Go on.
It's The Keep. Do you know The Keep?
Sort of.
It's, like, for those of you at home who may not know The Keep, it's, like, slightly reviled. The movie absolutely got ripped into pieces by the studio, too. But it's the story of the supernatural being that lives inside this crypt in Eastern Europe, and the Nazis, like, run into it, and it's, like, man, that movie absolutely... When we talk about religious angst, that movie really did a lot for me. I love that movie. Like, if Manhunter were not one of my, like, absolute favorite movies of all time, then it would be The Keep. Ironically, considering this conversation about the dad movie canon, Heat is not one of my favorite movies. How that movie ended up on the Sight and Sound list is just a sign that there are way too many Gen X critics out there.
Dads
and Gen Xers, just as far as the eye can see. But I really like The Insider, and I really respect The Insider in a lot of ways. There are a lot of things that it does super well.
What are your thoughts on Collateral?
It's fine.
Okay.
I don't understand. Again, Collateral has taken on, like, this slightly cult-like thing, as we all have sort of decided that Tom Cruise is, like, not merely a great movie star, but somehow also, like, really good for movies or something. I don't understand that one. I think it's a super competent, like, strong, nice thriller. Like, I don't have any problems with it as a movie. I think some of that is nostalgia for people making actual action movies, which I do understand. I understand why people miss that.
Yeah. I think that's why I most appreciate Michael Mann. Like, I wouldn't say any of his movies are among my favorite. Like, I enjoy Collateral. I enjoy Heat. Manhunter is good. But, yeah, I don't know that he has any of my favorites, but it's just like, dude puts together a good film.
I feel much the same way, and I'm actually kind of I'm pleased it turned out this way for this, and I say it like I have no control over what I pick. But also, Drill chose these movies, yeah. So like I really didn't have that much control over it. But it's nice for the David Lean episode to come up with like Martin Scorsese, who, of course, no one needs to tell you what a great director he is. And Michael Mann, who I think is, whether or not people enjoy his style or enjoy him, he is one of the most distinctive visual stylists of the past, what, like 35, 40 years in American movies? Like, again, I kind of like the wrong ones. Like, I know that people do like Manhunter, but that's because people love CSI. They don't love that one for the right reasons, man. It's so hard. There is a movie about the mortifying ordeal of being known, by the way. That's a picture about that particular feeling. And there are other movies of his that I do like. Like, I'm a big sucker for Last of the Mohicans, which, of course, turns into, at the very end, like, the last, like, 15, 20 minutes of that movie do not require dialogue, which I love about it. It's incredible photography, great acting, great music, and that adds up. And The Insider, which is professionally ugly, a movie where, like, you think about Thief, which is Michael Mann's first movie, which is this neon and bright colored thing, this sort of blue sheen on everything. It's a super, super aesthetic movie. And then you have The Insider, which is just like an ode to fluorescent lights, because that's where everything was being made. It's like a world of fluorescent lights, corporate journalist office, lawyer's office, all of that stuff it's just a world of fluorescence and ugliness and this sort of like, I don't know, it's nasty to be there. It's unpleasant to be there. David Lean had this incredible gift for making you feel whatever the weather was in a certain place. And that's true. I mean, that's true in like any movie of his that you want to talk about. Obviously, in Bridge on the River Kwai, you can sweat feeling the humidity in that movie. It absolutely comes through. And I think Michael Mann has the same kind of gift for like corporate American indoor style. Like, you feel that kind of oppression on it, whether it's Thief or whether it's Heat or whether it's The Insider here. So this film, for people who have not seen it or know it, this is one of the great journalism films in American cinema. I think that's fair to say. One of the reasons it's a great journalism film, and this is something we kind of touched on in our journalism movie rundown a while ago when we did All the President's Men, is that it understands that journalism is not heroic. It's not about great people doing incredibly brave things. There's a lot of hemming and hawing and hedging and cowardice in that industry, which is true of any industry. But it definitely cuts off this idea of journalists as heroes at the knees, which is one of the things I really admire about it. Not that they are incapable of doing the right thing, which is what happens in the movie, but that it's not some kind of straight, clear primrose path. It's a difficult road to walk, and for everyone involved, especially their source, who they hang out to dry pretty clearly, it's not a pleasant one at all. It does not give you all that many gains. So the basic idea of The Insider, based on a true story, they are using the people's real names. You have Al Pacino playing Lowell Bergman. You have Russell Crowe playing Jeffrey Wigand. You've got Christopher Plummer playing Mike Wallace in a very fun late Plummer role. I think he definitely figures out the Wallace thing. Like, he's like one step short of an SNL impersonation, but he absolutely gets it, that like Mike Wallace cantankerous listen, like, to quote somebody else's tweet, listen, my good bitch, you know, like, that's definitely the way that he brings forward his persona in that. And it's a really good cast all the way around. Bergman, the 60 Minutes producer, kind of believes in himself and believes in 60 Minutes. CBS is, you know, the way that people in that time period believed in 60 Minutes, which is that it's like the natural heir to Woodward and Bernstein style reporting. And like, you can absolutely find criticism of 60 Minutes as being too entertaining and being too invested in that sort of mic drop style of journalism, which frankly is a pretty decent critique of Mike Wallace, that he was always looking for that knockout punch style, which whether or not that made for great journalism is a completely different question. And there are plenty of people, plenty of contemporaries of Mike Wallace who would tell you he was not really a journalist. He was not like on the ground doing reporting. He was being a great TV personality, which is not the same thing. And Bergman sort of believes in this mission until they run across a whistleblower in the tobacco industry named Jeffrey Wigand. Wigand is a scientist. He's like one of the top scientists working for one of the tobacco companies. And he basically comes out and says, hey, man, the tobacco companies are not merely aware of how bad their product is for you, but they are working really hard to ensure that it becomes more addictive and worse for you, which is something that people like recognized. And at the same time, they like didn't quite understand at this moment in the early mid 90s where this conversation is being had. Something which I think our Gen Z people we surround ourselves with don't like understand super well.
By virtue of our professions? Or?
Yeah, not because we're trying to. No, because professionally...
That's why I was confused.
No, professionally that's how it is. But I think I think the Zoomers don't really understand how much smoking was part and parcel of American culture.
Now, this is interesting. I don't mean to totally derail us.
No, I want to talk about it. Right. I think it's interesting.
So I do, because I actually so we were talking about in Retcomp one day, just like, right, they were finding peer-reviewed articles, and we were talking about, okay, well, what makes good science too, and like how to discern data and findings and like figure out what's worthwhile, what weaknesses are, et cetera, et cetera. So we were talking about like data collection, sample size, you know, reading, all that good stuff. And so I was doing a running example, and I was like, okay, here, let's take these surveys real quick. Anonymous, you know, just answer either yes, no, or like one of the four options, whatever. Like, I'm just going to pitch you like Quizlet questions or whatever it was. And it was, the first one was like, how many of you smoke? And like, then I played around with like, how many of you smoke regularly? How many of you like, right, wording, phrasing, and that one overwhelmingly no. when I put different language on it, the answers changed. But then I had one that was like, do you smoke the following, like cigarettes, marijuana, whatever else I put, or vape? And then like, once you break it down, the yes jumps up entirely. And so I found that with mine anyway, there's this like weird understanding of what smoking means, but I think there is actually more than our generation. Like, I think it's kind of coming back because they don't have as much access to like how significant it was and how fast it will kill you. So like, it's this weird space where like, I don't know if they're doing cigarettes as much, but I think they're doing them more than we are. And like, also just what smoking means is kind of fundamentally different. Like, it was really interesting and confusing.
Yeah, the Zoomers are vaping. Like, that's the difference. Yeah. It's like, because like every single kid, because I was doing a lesson about like breaking down an article about syntaxes and you know, talking about smoking, and like the kids are like, yeah, no, dude, cigarettes are like the grossest thing in the world. Like, to a person, they're all like, none of us want to smoke cigarettes. I'm like, you're vaping though. And they're like, yes. Right? Like, and I'm like, you understand that's just as bad. And they're like, And I'm like, we should probably talk about this at some point. But like, they had all seen the same like scared straight stuff about smoking that we did when we were kids, you know, like the people who are smoking through the holes in their tracheotomies, like that's a classic. Like they all get the same stuff. I bring this up for this because I think The Insider does a really, really good job of marking that moment in time where people sort of understand that cigarettes are bad for you, but no one's going to do anything about it. And how much that has just completely altered within the past few years. Cause like I told them, I'm old enough to remember when you might go into like an Applebee's and like, they'd say smoking or non-smoking, you know? And like, they're like, wait a second, you could do what? And like, yes, you could smoke at a restaurant. And like, that's
or
like
different hotel rooms.
Yeah. Yeah, your different hotel rooms, or you could even try to get like smoking tickets for your airplane. Like there's like different stuff going on. And what's so interesting about that is like the way that The Insider treats that, it treats it as it's because the cigarette companies are and tobacco companies, I guess we should call them, are so powerful and so frightening. Even to something like CBS, which you wouldn't think has anything to do with them. But if the cigarette companies say, we will obliterate you in court, or we'll take out all of your advertising or stuff like that, like it just scares them so much. And like I think people are not the same way about tobacco companies now, because I don't think anybody likes the tobacco companies. Like, they're no longer your like trusted friendly brands anymore. Like, whatever people
are making the vapes though. Like,
yeah, which is why, you know, nobody has Marlboro right across their vape, because that's, you know, let's put it this way, it's kind of a poisonous brand at this point in the way that other stuff isn't.
I will say though, old cigarette ads are great for teaching visual rhetoric.
Oh, they're incredible.
The Marlboro Man reminded me of this, but just like, whew, boy howdy, those are rife.
The "You've Come a Long Way, Baby" ones are just absolutely stunning. That's like, you could do a course on what those mean.
Or the I forget the exact tagline, but how they tried to pitch them as like, they don't destroy your throat.
Yeah, it feels like nice and cool. It's like, yeah.
The smoothness. So.
What a world. Speaking of the world that we live in, are you ready for the...
Okay. I had two guesses. I forgot what one of them was, so I guess I have one guess.
I'm a little disappointed with myself for this one because it's kind of on the nose, but go for it.
Okay. Oh, no, I do remember the other one. One of them was... there's something else in there, but like, politics is back, baby, woof howl.
Ooh. It is not that one.
The other one was, we often say drunk driving is bad, but it's also responsible for people getting to work on time.
That's exactly right. Drunk driving may kill a lot of people, but it also helps a lot of people get to work on time. So it's impossible to say if it's bad or not. And like, that's just like the attitude that everyone has to fight in the second half of this movie. And by everyone, I mean Jeffrey Wigand and Lowell Bergman. This idea of, well, it pays the bills, or it keeps us safe as a company to not get sued into oblivion by RJ Reynolds or whatever the company is, B&W, I think. And like, that's basically what it comes down to. Like, we understand that this is bad. We understand that it looks bad. We understand it's bad for like the First Amendment and stuff. And yet the suits at CBS include, and for a moment, Mike Wallace too, just sort of look at it and say, you know, it seems like smoking is bad. It seems like these people have really, really taken it out on Jeffrey Wigand. They're really trying to make his life miserable, whether it's by giving him this nasty NDA, which puts him in a position of extreme legal tenuousness. And they've like also started threatening his family and leaving creepy notes in his mailbox and shadowing people as they're going out and about. Like, we understand that, but it also helps people to get to work on time. Like, and that, like, that idea is just so much at the heart of this film, that there are people who are really just like, but it helps people get to work on time. And whether or not that's even true is a completely different thing to talk about. But that is the attitude, which I think is just as oppressive as those fluorescent lights in this movie. These people who are just so willing to both sides it, because it, you know, who really wants to make a moral decision about this? Who really wants to make a stand? Who like really wants to put anything on the line? We have a show that we try to put out each week that we try to make money off of, and we personally would benefit from a corporate merger. And, you know, if CBS is getting sued, we won't make that money. We won't get those bonuses. And that's basically the way that this movie has to like fight through itself for a very long time.
You know who actually like solved this problem narratively? Seinfeld.
Go on.
No, just the episode where they sue the tobacco company and then Kramer becomes the Marlboro Man in Times Square.
Oh, that's right. That is right.
Look at me. Who could love me?
Well, that's my...
That was it. Sorry.
No, I mean, but that's basically my shtick on the drunk driving one is that I think that really does sum up like the ethical argument, which is interesting in the way too that it filters down even to people who consider themselves like more upright or more virtuous than other people. Obviously, Jeffrey Wigand is completely horrified, burned out by the fact that the CBS is basically leaving him out to dry, which is fair. But it also causes Lowell Bergman to like really reevaluate what kind of work he has been doing, and like having to think about whether or not it's something which is endemic to the entire like TV news thing. Like, even like at the end of the film, he goes off and gets a different job because he can't work with these people anymore. But even then, you're sort of stuck thinking like, what is there supposed to be some other group, some other like journalist group out there that's not going to cave to pressure like this, that isn't going to require, essentially the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, like print media, to go criticize them? Like, what are you supposed to do with that? It's a very, very, like, the ending is good. Like, it's a happy ending in the sense that the tobacco companies lose, Jeffrey Wigand can get his life back a little bit, the press doesn't ultimately collapse, but like, it is also a very, very sobering movie, because The Insider doesn't pretend like it was bound to happen that way, which is another thing I really respect about it as a journalism film, is that the movie doesn't act like, oh, they were always going to do the right thing. It definitely lets you linger with, well, what if they don't? And in fact, not just what if they don't, but it seems really likely that they won't do the right thing.
This isn't drill, but I think it's Oliver Willis. I mean, other people.
I was about to say,
this.
That is not the same guy.
No, it's not. It is related, though. He was talking at one point about, like, too many people have West Wing brain, and that they automatically assume, like, oh, if you bring logic or facts or just, like, believe in the moral character of others, that everything will work out and everyone will listen. And it's just, like, that's just not how it works, and we need to realize that to actually affect any change. And The Insider, like, actually approaches it in that productive way, rather than assuming everyone... rather than assuming a rational universe, which is just not how it works. Like, power compels.
All right, you ready for Ready for spiel here?
Only if it's delivered entirely in drill quotes.
It's the weekend, baby. You know what that means. It's time to drink precisely one beer and call 911. That one was on my list of ones I really wanted to get into. So was the one about you are all my wives and become more so every day.
The worst part of nationalism is having to pretend the flag is really good.
You know, the one that I actually really like worked hard to find a good fit for, but I couldn't, was the one about sorry, I'm trying to remove it. The Jared Fogle girls online at me one. Like, I really, really wanted that, but in the end, I went with drunk driving instead.
Trying to think what movie that one would fit.
I know. Well, it's going to take up your weekend, too, and then you're going to drink precisely one beer and one call 911. So our theme for this week was, I don't know, just drill tweets? I guess that's what we're calling this episode. Based on Bridge on the River Kwai, where it really does come down to this very interesting moment. Like, the movie's entire plot hinges more on that moment with Joyce in the forest, where he's woke, he won't do it. He's not going to take out Dracula with a sniper rifle. That moment of individual conscience being stronger than military duty. And he's the only person in there who, in the film, you know, out of the key figures like Nicholson and Saito and Warden, who, you know, hasn't managed to pervert this idea of military responsibility into a personal identity. He still has, like, some level of the human in him, which very few other people do have. But thinking about that moment and thinking about he won't do it, he's woke, he won't take the shot, that sort of put me in mind of other favorite drill tweets that would allow us to think about movies. And there's the King of Comedy, the story of Rupert Pupkin, who just does not quit, has a goal that he's going to become the next great late night figure. And no matter who yells at him, whether it's Sandra Bernhard, whether it's the lady at reception, whether it's Jerry Lewis, or whether it's the voice of Catherine Scorsese, which I don't know that I mentioned, but his mom, like, yells at him from upstairs a lot. It's like, stop yelling, stop making so much noise, the neighbors are complaining. Catherine Scorsese, the god, anyway. No matter who it is, go ahead, keep screaming shut the fuck up at me. It only makes my opinions worse, because it only does worse things to him. He goes from being basically a benign doofus with big loser energy, and then turns into a kidnapper who uses that to try to get on the air. Just a truly odd movie, that one. And then on the other side of this, we have The Insider, which is the story about an incredible amount of personal courage and personal resolve, especially as Russell Crowe plays Jeffrey Wigand, which I didn't, like, talk about a lot here, but it is really, like, one of his best performances. Just this personally quiet, low-key kind of person who also has this incredible anger inside of him, sort of like Russell Crowe in real life. And that film, Drunk Driving, may kill a lot of people, but it also helps a lot of people get to work on time, so it's impossible to say if it's bad or not. The conflict here is not about Jeffrey Wigand. It's not about B&W. It's about CBS. It's about a giant multi-billion-dollar company that simply refuses to do the right thing because it might cost them a couple bucks. You know, it might make things unpleasant for the people at the top. Rather than doing something which is not merely right from a journalistic perspective, to be doing the right thing by their source, but also something which would obviously be beneficial for their millions of viewers. So those are our two films here. WWDD.
Boy, that's a question. In my head, I was like, well, I'm going to pick the one that, like, just feels most like a Drill tweet, but what would Drill do is probably the opposite. I'm going to go with the King of Comedy, though, because I just feel like that one is closest to, like, a Drill movie. And like the ways in which we describe Drill, the kind of humor that's happening there, the like ethos of that, I think that's very, very much part of the King of Comedy too. That like it would be, I'm trying to think how to say this. Like, you know whoever's making it is in on the joke, but it would be, like, terribly unsettling and cringe if you didn't know that. But also, the sheer commitment to it and Drill himself or De Niro or whatever, like, right, also takes it back to this space of discomfort. And it's just absurdism and terribly thought out things that, like, makes sense if you think about him enough, but then it's like, wait, no, that's still bad. And I don't know, there's a lot of overlap between those two, so I'm gonna go with the King of Comedy, even though, like, I kind of want to pick the Insider just for Michael Mann, but
no, the King of Comedy one absolutely makes a lot of sense to me. There it is sort of a pre-Drill tweet. It's like,
yeah,
weird film Twitter, as it were, you know, like there is something about it which is just like funny because you're like making this sort of like weird groaning noise at the screen, which is what happens for so many Drill tweets for me anyway.
I guess if we think of like the King of Comedy is just being ripped off by other stuff now, Drill is certainly that too. So
that's actually an incredible point. And it makes me sad to think about it. So if you liked this episode and you want to hear the exact opposite of it being done by the same people, there's an episode, the part one of this, about Belle and Sebastian that Matt and I did together before. You can find that.
I hate when girls think I'm proposing when I take the knee at them in protest.
If you want to hear more things like this that are just us laughing at Drill tweets, or talking very seriously about the art that we like, you can find that episode. You can find other back episodes. You can find links to his playlist, my reviews. You can find links to both blogs at subtitlespodcast.com. And I know I usually say something different here, but I'm
leave us with a Drill, man.
Blocked. You're all blocked. None of you are free of sin.